Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. So yesterday, before the House Judiciary Committee, a blunt instrument met a bunch of dull instruments. Corey Lewandowski testifying before Jerry Nadler and crew. He opened his opening statement, sort of set the tone for his approach to House Judiciary Democrats for the rest of his time.
I think in one form or another, I've already answered questions for well over 20 hours. So now here I am before the House Judiciary Committee to answer the same questions again. Just last week, this committee, over the objections of the minority, unilaterally changed the rules to make this an impeachment proceeding, which is very unfair. However, in the spirit of cooperation, I am prepared to move forward today.
Although he wasn't terribly cooperative, understandably so. We'll get to that in a moment. But he did come with lines. Corey Lewandowski had jokes as part of his approach.
Whether it was bad actors at the FBI and the intelligence community, or lies coming from members of the current House majority that there was evidence of collusion, the American people continue to be sold a false narrative with the purpose of undermining the legitimacy of the 2016 election results. But no matter the size, campaigns are not always the most efficient organizations. And while you run in single congressional districts, just imagine what it's like to lead a national campaign that spans all 50 states of the union. During my time as campaign manager, there were competing interests for the candidate's time. And a sea of ideas, some laudable, some sound, a few not so much, many of which were dismissed out of hand. Others were passed on to staffers to be handled. I also received hundreds of thousands of emails, some days with as many as 1,000 emails. And unlike Hillary Clinton, I don't think I ever deleted any of those.
Zing.
Many of them were responded to with either one-word answers or forwarded to other staffers for additional follow-up. But throughout it all, and to the best of my recollection, I don't ever recall having any conversations with foreign entities, let alone any who were offering to help to manipulate the outcome of an election.
That was his repeated declaration about the lack of interaction with any foreign agents with respect to the election or anything else for that matter. And it just, I mean, it was basically just hours on end of every Democrat having their opportunity to ask him the question about the passage in the Mueller report that indicates that Lewandowski was tasked to go to Jeff Sessions and ask him to unrecuse himself. And ultimately, Lewandowski allegedly tasks somebody else to do that. And that's evidence of obstruction, and that's evidence of a guilty heart. And so congressional Democrats, House Judiciary Democrats, just took their turns beating him up over that single issue.
And that, no one really asked a question. They were all just rants, and they were, you know, and then they accused him, you're wasting time, you're stonewalling. But Sheila Jackson Lee, oh my God, I wanted a bopper.
Volume two. When the president asked you, did you hear the question?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question, Congressman?
When the president asked you to deliver that message, did he, the president, tell you that 2 days before your meeting, his White House counsel had refused to fire the special counsel?
The White House has directed me that I not disclose the substance of any conversations with the
you
president.
You are not allowed to answer whether the president told you he called his counsel at home on Saturday to remove, on a Saturday, remove the special counsel. His counsel said no. The president had also personally called Sessions at home and asked him to unrecuse himself and oversee the special counsel's investigation, and Sessions said no. When the president asked you to deliver his message to Sessions, did the president tell you that Sessions had already said no? Volume 2, page 107?
Again, Congresswoman, I recognize that the privilege is not mine, but I've been asked by the White House to... Congresswoman, I'd be happy to answer your question, or you can just have a conversation by yourself. But if you'd like to ask me a question, I'll be happy to answer.
I'm going to continue. The reason is...
Well, then don't ask me a question if you don't want to hear my answer.
I'm reclaiming my time. This is a House judiciary, not a House party.
So if you ask me a question, give me the opportunity to answer your question.
The very campaign the special counsel was investigating. I'd like my time restored, please, of his interruption.
And she didn't get her time restored.
And
this is not a House party, okay?
And then she asked Corey Lewandowski if he had the pictures of the flag that Neil Armstrong planted on Mars. She wants those pictures.
Okay. It's hard to take some of these Democratic lawmakers seriously.
It's hard to take any of them seriously.
I mean, how people put these people in office? Judiciary Committee hearings, you could really get to see the person. And, you know, they have people behind them giving them paper to read questions. They don't know anything on their own.
Lewandowski is, I'm not a particular fan of Lewandowski. I don't think he's particularly talented from what we've seen of him. But he is a blunt instrument. And he did an effective job of pushing back, not allowing them to start from their premises if he asserted they were false. And just frankly, moments using ridicule and stonewalling to demonstrate the absurdity of the whole thing. It was actually quite effective. And there was no more entertaining moment for me than the interchange between Corey Lewandowski and former presidential candidate Eric Swalwell.
Oh, boy.
This was about who is going to read what. This gives you a sense of the importance of what transpired before the House Judiciary Committee yesterday. Listen to this.
Mr. Lewandowski, I'm going to put a slide up, and it's the words that President Trump dictated to you on July 19. Can you read what you wrote down?
I'm happy to have you read it, Congressman.
Well, why don't you want to read it, Mr. Lewandowski?
I think you should afford me the same privilege you afforded Director Mueller.
Would you like to read it?
No, you're welcome to read it.
Are you ashamed of the words that you wrote down?
President Swalwell, I'm very happy of what I've written, but you're welcome to read it if you'd like.
Are you ashamed to read it out loud?
I'm not ashamed of anything in my life, Congressman. Are you?
Then why don't you read the words?
Congressman, I've asked and answered your question.
Mr. Lewandowski, why won't you read the words aloud?
I've asked and answered your question, Congressman. If you'd like to read the words, you're welcome to.
Well, you were ashamed to read them out loud, and you didn't deliver those words to the person the president asked you to. Did you have a consciousness of guilt?
I have nothing to be guilty of, Congressman. Thank you.
You still feel guilty today, and that's why you can't read it out loud?
Congressman, you're welcome to read the words if you'd like.
Well, I just wonder why you can't.
Right? I have the capacity to, Congressman. I'll give you the privilege.
You said the president did nothing wrong. Why can't you read those words right now? Why can't you read them aloud?
Congressman, tell me why you hold me to a different standard than the previous witnesses who sat here.
At least one of those gentlemen, I believe, cannot read. And that's why there was a standoff.
Why don't you read it?
I also think of that exchange. That's exactly how I pictured a game of Scrabble between Mike Tyson and Richie Daly.
You read it.
I'm... I mean,
D-stemption, don't you spell it out.
So just to give you a flavor of it. Now, there were a few Republicans who spoke up after the circus atmosphere the Democrats created. And Jim Jordan, as he is wont to do, nicely summarized the whole proceeding in under 60 seconds.
So you were part of the campaign operation at some level or another from January 2015 to November 8th, 2016. During that entire time, do you guys ever work with Russia to impact the election?
No.
And you know what's interesting, Mr. Lewandowski? When Jim Comey was asked that same question, sitting at that same table, he gave the same answer. When Bob Mueller was asked that same question, sitting at that same table, he gave the same answer. Falsely accused, the president is falsely accused of colluding with a foreign state to impact the election. Jim Comey, when we deposed him at that very table, said after 10 months of investigation, we didn't have a thing. Bob Mueller gets named special counsel. He wastes $30 million of taxpayer money, 22-month investigation. He sits at that table just a few weeks ago and gives the same darn answer. But these guys over here, they don't care. They don't care. They don't want to get to what Mr. Chavez said. They don't want to figure out how the false accusation happened. They just want to drag people in front of this committee and keep trying to find some way they can go after the president.
Yeah, I think that's about right. They got nothing.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Cokie Roberts passes away at the age of 75.
Oh, very sad.
Now, I didn't realize that at first. When this news started breaking, I get most of my news from Al Sharpton.
Yeah.
And so I thought Cokie.
Well, Cokie. Yeah, Cokie.
No.
He made them.
No, not Cokie. Cokie.
Cokie. Cokie.
I thought this is who had passed away.
Now, what starts with the letter C? Cokie starts with C. Let's think of other things that starts with C. Who cares about other things? C is for Cokie.
Yeah.
That's good enough for me. C
I was
is for
afraid
Cokie.
That
that's
good enough for the Cokie me. Monster had left C us, but it's Cokie. Not Cokie.
No, it's not good enough
it's Cokie Roberts.
And she had a storied career. I mean, 40 years in television, public radio, publishing. Thank goodness, we went to the Republican convention in Cleveland because I got to meet her, and she had some advice for me.
Just do your work and get it on the air, and then people will see that you're good.
Yeah, she was great.
A stirring tribute from Al Sharpton, who had a nice photo collage of Cokie, too. I mean, it happened to be Christiane Amanpour, but nonetheless, it's the...
Know who died and know their name. That's the first thing you should do. And then get the picture right.
I wonder if Al Sharpton will be invited to offer a eulogy at the Roberts Memorial Service.
Well, in her last interview, she did mention how she wanted to be remembered.
I'd like to be remembered as a mother and a wife and friend of people that I love very, very much.
Very personal. Did you get a chance to meet her at the Republican convention?
No.
No? Oh, she didn't have the... Cokie didn't have the same effect on you, Cokie.
No.
No? Okay.
Journalists are not celebrities.
Oh, she...
Most of them are unimportant.
I saw her in the back of an Uber car. She wasn't like a star that had makeup artists with her and drivers. She walked out with us.
Yeah.
And that's when we had the nice conversation. I had the cane because I had a broken foot, and we walked out together, and she jumped in an Uber. She was very down to earth.
Mm-hmm.
But she had, you know, fought breast cancer, and it came back, and then she passed away. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
All right. I just wanted to make sure that people were properly informed of the stirring tribute from Reverend Al Sharpton for Cokie Amanpour. This is why journalists, these political reverends in quotation marks. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, just I'm sorry she passed away. I don't get into the self-congratulatory nonsense of these sort of celebutant journalists in our celebrity culture. And so I know everybody's wringing their hands and offering these hagiographs on Cokie Roberts's career, pioneer. She graduated from Wellesley in 1962. Everything is said breathlessly.
Her parents were both congresspeople. Her dad died in a plane crash, and the mom took over that congressional seat.
Right. So she was...
Back when women weren't in politics.
She... Yeah, right. Well. All the pioneer stuff. She, you know, it's unfortunate. It's sad. Want to say what we those things that we extol, we beget. Those individuals that we memorialize in such a public way, almost it's almost demanded that we memorialize them. It says something about our culture too, and it's not a great commentary.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. Tickets for Freedom Summit Chicago are on sale now at freedomsummitchicago.com. That's freedomsummitchicago.com.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. The left's youngest nightmare is how he's described 17-year-old CJ Pearson, who says he's been conservative since the second grade.
Wow, good for him.
Sort of the Alex P. Keaton of his generation.
Yeah.
I assume he takes a briefcase to high school. We'll be taking one this morning.
Wears a suit and tie every day.
Right. Spends his study periods working on entrepreneurial ventures, working through white papers on public policy issues. But he gave an interesting interview in a podcast over at Daily Signal with Rob Bluey that piqued my interest. And I've heard about him before. I've seen some firestorms he's created on Twitter just by being a young black conservative. So I thought, well, this will be fun to have him on the show. And so we did. And now we do. CJ Pearson, political analyst, commentator, high school senior. CJ, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, thank you, Dan and Amy, for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
All right. Make sure you eat a healthy breakfast before school. We don't want you, getting tired by the afternoon. I'm sure
exactly. I just thought of Pop-Tart.
Pop-Tart.
Pop-Tart. Breakfast of champions.
There you
right
go.
There.
Give us a bit of the backstory on your conservatism and then your activism in elementary school as well as high school and how that's been received.
Definitely, definitely. So I first got involved in politics in the second grade. It was something that immediately clicked with me. There was a mock presidential election in that time. It was 2008, so the two candidates were John McCain and Barack Obama. And our second grade teacher had some pretty audacious goals for us second graders. She wanted us to do what every good citizen at the time was doing. She wanted us to research the candidates. I watched the debate, and I did just that, and I walked away captivated. I didn't know necessarily what healthcare policy was or what immigration reform meant, but I knew that these were very important issues, and I wanted to learn more. And so that kind of pushed me towards a period of intense self-discovery in which I definitely tried to find out where I fit on the issues. And when I looked at conservative values, when I looked at values like social responsibility, fiscal responsibility, a love of country and God, those values were values that I was that were instilled within me ever since I was a kid. So it was an easy transition for me to conservative values.
So when you were 7 years old, I mean, could you process what healthcare reform was and what Iran was doing that was so bad?
Yeah, you know, I couldn't. But I remember watching John McCain and Barack Obama going back and forth on that debate stage and realizing the importance of what they were doing. And it was that really served as the catalyst of me wanting to become more informed, wanting to become more involved. Because I feel like we have a tendency now for everyone just to have an opinion just for the sake of having an opinion. And even back then, I just wasn't that type of kid. I wanted to know what I was talking about. I wanted to hold on in discussion. And I started reading the newspaper with my grandfather every single morning. You know, I watched Fox News, I watched CNN, I watched them all because I wanted to know more, I wanted to learn more, and I wanted to understand those issues that have such a huge impact on the political discourse of our country.
And so when the kids would say, hey, CJ, you want to go play ball with us, you would say, hey, do you want to study marginal tax rates with me instead? Is that how that went?
Yeah. You know, that was always fun. You know, like, I would definitely make time for my friends, but, you know, I definitely had different hobbies, different interests. It's so funny that you heard that interview on the Heritage Foundation. That was actually one of the first places I went to when I was looking to understand conservatism. I remember you were joking about reading white papers. I was actually reading white papers about immigration reform and the trade deficit and all these things like in the fourth or fifth grade. And it was definitely something that was really peculiar to a lot of people. A lot of people didn't understand it. But I think now, and this is a huge credit to Trump, he has definitely allowed for more people who had been previously completely apathetic to politics to become more involved and realize the importance of the issues that are debated each and every day, especially for young people. That's been the biggest thing that I've tried to do above all, to show young people that our voices matter and that we need to be vocal about the issues that are affecting our country today.
And how are you received among your high school classmates and high school teachers with your activism?
Yeah. You know, I've gotten into a few staff with teachers, and, you know, it's always interesting. I think a lot of teachers feel as if, you know, that they can just, you know, impart their values into students, and, you know, they won't know any better. I took AP government my sophomore year. My teacher was pretty liberal,
and she wore her hate of Trump pretty proudly on her sleeve. And then she would just say things like, Trump is a racist. And I would raise my hand. I'd be like, no, he's not. Here's why. Let's look at the lowest black unemployment rate in our history. Let's look at more black people owning homes than ever before. Let's look at wage rising in the black community. Let's look at economic opportunity zones. And literally everyone would talk to you like, whoa, maybe he isn't a racist. And so I think that underscores the importance of ensuring that young people understand conservative values, that are able, and then we put them in the best position to defend their ideals and defend their values. As far as the reception I've gotten from my friends, you know, sometimes, you know, I, of course, I've heard negative things. I've been called, you know, an Uncle Tom. I've been called, you know, racial epithets, all those things. But I've also gotten a lot of positive feedback from people who told me that they admire the fact that I am politically involved and that they look to that, you know, as inspiration for what they could do. And those are definitely comments that mean the most to me.
And you also live in a house divided. You live in Georgia, and your parents have always voted Democratic, correct?
Yeah. They are card-carrying Democrats. It was a very interesting time during the election. So they were, of course, devout Hillary Clinton supporters. I, of course, supported President Trump and his successful campaign, which I always went after them. And then we had this yard sign war, basically. So they had a Hillary Clinton yard sign. I had my Trump yard sign. And we would alternate the days in which one yard sign would be in the backyard and the other would be in the front yard. So it definitely is a very interesting dynamic we have in my household, for sure. And it makes for some really interesting dinner time discussion. But at the end of the day, I think, you know, I've learned a lot from it. I think it's definitely showed me the importance of respecting other people's ideals. And it's also helped me understand the left argument. I think you can understand bad ideas and still believe, you know, strongly in your own. And I think that's made me a better advocate for my own beliefs, because I understand why they believe that we should raise the minimum wage. I understand why they believe that, you know, America is systemically racist. I may disagree with those conclusions, but I think understanding their argument is crucial to defending my own.
So are you going to graduate from high school, then turn pro right away, run for office at 18, or are you going to go on to college first?
So right now, you know, I'm definitely looking at a few options after high school. I'm super excited. You know, high school has been fun, but I'm so glad that it's coming to an end. But I'm definitely excited for what lies next, you know, whether that may be college or maybe that will be jumping right into things. But at the end of the day, above all else, I'm most excited about pursuing any and all opportunity that allows me to give back to the country that's given so much to me.
CJ,
you know, America is the greatest. Yeah.
I just wanted to let you know, Amy, you're in your senior year. If you need a date for prom, my colleague Amy Jacobson is the Illinois record holder for number of proms attended. She'd be happy to travel down to Georgia.
Yeah, I've been to 8. I've been asked to 9, but I've attended 8.
Yeah.
Come to Georgia.
I'm a very good date. I'm very well behaved.
Yeah.
And I can dance, and we could have a really good time. And
you could, the street cred you would have with your colleagues and your students, your fellow students, because you would be there with an older woman. I mean, much older.
I know.
Much older woman.
Not much older. She's at the prime of her life.
Yes.
Yeah.
I am.
Oh, such a gentleman.
This is a smooth
operator.
I mean, honestly,
this guy's
going to
be. It's unfortunate we have to wait for 30 till he's 35 before CJ
can
become president. CJ, what about the racial aspect of it? You mentioned you've been called names because you're black and conservative, and it seems to me you take that very much in stride. You're not whining about bullying. You're using that as motivation to be more active.
Yeah, for sure. It doesn't really affect me much anymore. I think at the end of the day, Democrats have for a long time believed that they own black people. And it's so interesting to witness their entitlement when they have not done really anything for black people. You look at cities like Detroit, you look at even cities like Chicago, in which they've been ran for decades by, you know, liberal politicians, and black people have consistently been underserved and given the short end of the stick time and again. You know, I think it is definitely It's very telling that certain people in inner city communities, anti-Democrats, don't feel comfortable allowing their kids to go stay outside without the danger of their children's head being blown off by a gun. And I think at the end of the day, that's why, you know, you can call me any name you want. Black liberals can attack me, but at the end of the day, I'm not going to defend a party that not only enslaved me and segregated me, but literally tried to put my great-grandson to the back of the bus. I can't do that in good faith. Maybe they can, and I wish them the best in their effort, but I refuse to.
And CJ, what are your political aspirations? I mean, do you one day want to be president of the United States?
You know, I don't know, but I think at the end of the day, I do believe that this is a country that has given so much to me, and I look forward to any and all opportunity to serve it and give back. You know, America is the pinnacle of greatness. We truly are a shining city on our hill. And I think any way in which we can ensure that we maintain that prominence in this world, if I can ever contribute to that, it's definitely going to be an opportunity that I look to with enthusiasm and passion.
All right, we're going to let you get off to that calculus class that you're running late for now. C.J. Pearson, political analyst, commentator, and high school senior. Remember the name C.J. Pearson. You're going to be hearing a lot more from him. C.J., thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The more you listen, the more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer. Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Dan and Amy getting some good reactions to our C.J. Pearson interview, the 17-year-old high school senior from Georgia who is a conservative activist. You just heard from him.
He might take me to prom, too.
Very articulate young man. He may take Amy to prom. He may run for president in 18 short years.
Yes.
Or 17, actually, because then as long as he's 35 when he's sworn in. Jim in Tampa, Florida, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
That was a great interview. Congratulations for putting him on and letting him talk. And congratulations to CJ's second grade teacher for setting that bar high. Kids can do way more than we ask of them. And well done. Great job, guys.
Thanks for the call, Jim. Yeah, it is interesting. We have this sort of schizophrenia when it comes to kids, right? They're infants until they're 26 and off mom and dad's health
insurance.
They're to be coddled and protected from a coarse word. And yet they're also supposed to direct us on gun control policy, on climate change policy.
On the sale of vaping products. I mean, they really, they have a lot more power.
They can go off to war at 18, but they shouldn't be able to own a gun. I mean, I'm a little bit, it's a sort of a muddled situation with how we view children in terms of their abilities, as Jim was saying, the expectations that we have for them, the protections that are afforded them. I'm not talking about legal protection. I mean, like protection from growing up.
Well, they have safe spaces for kids at school.
Rooms
for kids. They have the buddy bench. Just, you know, they are completely coddled. But I love what you said to CJ, because people, you know, he is African-American conservative and people make fun of him. And I love the question you said. He doesn't use it as, oh, I've been bullied. I'm a victim. He's a man about it. And he handles it like an adult. And I love
that. Well, he handles it better than most adults.
Yeah, you're right.
He uses his motivation. I mean, he's thinking through these things. Look, I know what you're doing. When you use a pejorative, an ad hominem, an epithet against me, I know what you're doing. You can't address me on the merits, so you have to name call to try and marginalize me because you can't marginalize me intellectually. I know what you're doing. That kid is sharp. That's good. Speaking of adults behaving badly, professional athlete police blotter update. Did you see this? This is the Pittsburgh Pirates closer. They were just in town over the weekend.
I know.
Felipe Vasquez, who's a two-time All-Star. I mean, he is a shutdown artist. He was arrested.
He's in jail this morning, guys.
Charged with statutory sexual assault in an unrelated case in Pennsylvania already. He has been hit with charges of solicitation of a child. He was communicating with a 13-year-old girl and was talking about starting up a sexual relationship with her.
Yeah, the victim is now 15, but they for years have had this ongoing text-based relationship. And recently received a video from Vasquez in which he performed a sex act. So somebody
The adult.
The adult.
Right. The Pittsburgh Pirates closer.
Yeah. Performed a sex act, videotaped it, and sent it to this 13-year-old girl. And it's been going on for, and I mean, that's not all he did, but he's in jail this morning, waiting extradition to Lee County, Florida, where the sex act was recorded.
And
he's already cleaned out his locker, by the way. Somebody came in and took his items out, so I'm sure he's going to be off the team.
In other news, we've got a Jussie Smollett copycat down in
Georgia.
Don Lewis Kaufman, who was a former tackle for the Tampa Bay Bucks, went back in Florida again. He committed insurance fraud, black spray paint, writing racially motivated words, swastikas.
And?
MAGA, of course.
Right, you wrote MAGA on the property.
On the property, a restaurant that he owned.
Right, so he wanted to, you know, get an insurance, you know, payout by claiming that certain items were broken, certain machines were broken, and he's Jussie Smollett.
And unlike Jussie Smollett in Cook County, Kaufman charged with false report of a crime, insurance fraud, concealing a license plate. He's actually getting prosecuted. That's the difference between Georgia and Cook County, Illinois.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. We've said it here many a time on this show. The rise of cultural Marxism, humorless as it is, will be the end of comedy. Forget Mel Brooks saying he couldn't make Blazing Saddles today. No. Steve Carell saying he couldn't make The Office today. Jerry Seinfeld wondering if he could make Seinfeld today. Happens quickly, doesn't it? Much more quickly than Shane Gillis was expecting, I'll tell you that. Shane Gillis, who's a comedian most of you probably never heard of, and for all kinds of good reasons, he was part of the new cast of SNL until he wasn't. Until a freelance journalist comedy reporter named Seth Simons posted a few clips of Gillis and his co-host, Matt McCusker, on a podcast they had in 2018. Matt and Shane's Secret Podcast is what it was called. And here's a little flavor of it, including some of the
inflammatory remarks that he made.
The remarks that got him fired from SNL before he started, effectively.
Damn, Chinatown's fucking nuts.
It's crazy, dude.
It is full fucking China, dude. It's fucking Chinese down there.
I wonder how that started. They just built one fucked up looking building and people were like, all right, no one said anything.
Let's live there, huh?
Well, they built these fucking like huge Shanghai houses. The first one must have infuriated everyone. They
like, I'm like, what are you guys doing here? Let's get these ducks out of that window.
You know what? Yeah, true. Also, I'm always like, how can there be so many fucking restaurants down here?
All rest. Well, because
you go in, there's like one person eating ever.
Fat white idiots like me are down there. True. Sucking down neuters.
I hate China. I hate the food at Chinatown. Sucks. Chinese food's a very dishonest cuisine.
I don't even want to think about it.
They invented a fucking chemical to put in their food to make it delicious, dude.
It is.
They made MSG.
Good for them.
It's a dishonest food, dude. There's nothing. There's nothing to it. It's shitty
very
meat.
Honorable.
Shitty meat. A chemical they made up to fuck your body up, and noodles. Neuters.
The neuters are
the cheapest
great.
Thing in the world.
We got
chemical.
Sick.
Worst meat you can find.
Okay, that's one of the things.
Oh my gosh, I'm so offended.
Mocking Asian accents. In addition to that, they called director Judd Apatow and another stand-up comedian white F-word, a derisive word for homosexuals, white F-word comics. Use the F word.
Oh, so offended.
In addition to that, they talked about Muslims in one episode of their podcast. They talked about Muslim heaven with Gillis telling McCusker, quote, you got to spill blood. You got to praise Allah by spilling blood.
Tell me when I'm supposed to be offended.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Should Shane Gillis have been fired by Lorne Michaels? His response to the statement he released was
pretty awesome.
Rather interesting. He writes, it feels ridiculous for comedians to be making serious public statements, but here we are. It really does. That's a good commentary. And by the way, at the top of the 8 o'clock hour, Tim Slagle, who's a stand-up comedian and conservative, and is in town this week performing at comedy clubs, will join us. So he'll have some commentary on this too, and how difficult it is to be a comedian nowadays, where you can't offend people.
But that's what comedy is, because you can laugh
controversial.
At yourself.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't take offense when people are like, oh, you're a dumb Swede or you're a dumb blonde. I'm like, okay. You know, and people use different cultural references and comedy acts, and it's sometimes funny. Am I racist because I laugh sometimes at jokes? No, are you?
Well, using the racial epithet against Chinese people that you could figure out was used. So I don't know. Should we go back to everybody?
I'm a dumb blonde. I can't figure.
Should we go back to everybody who graduated from Pekin High School before 1980, and send them off to sensitivity training? You know, Pekin High School.
I know, it was a Pekin Jinx forever. Mm-hmm. We played them. We always did the Pekin Thanksgiving tournament down there, and their T-shirt had an Asian person with the rice hat on.
What about Jim Jeffries? What about the point Jim Jeffries raises? Jim Jeffries, another stand-up comedian, Bill Burr as well,
and Rob Schneider. They're sticking up for him.
Jeffries pointing out, how about John Belushi's samurai skit?
Oh, that's right.
How about Mike Myers as the Japanese game show host? Burr arguing that if you look at anyone's past, you find unflattering things. We're not running for office, said Bill Burr. When is this going to end? He also blamed millennials, saying they're a bunch of rats.
I know.
None of them,
all they want to do is get people in trouble.
Yeah, none of them care. And this was also a topic Dave Chappelle, a great comedian, took up in his recent Netflix special.
Celebrity hunting season. Doesn't matter what I say, they're going to get everybody eventually. Like, look, I don't think I did anything wrong, but we'll see.
We'll see. Shane Gillis probably thought the same thing. I mean, now thinking about stand-up comedy, would Jackie Mason have had a career today? Would Rodney Dangerfield? Yeah. Don Rickles obviously wouldn't.
No.
What about George Carlin?
Oh, gosh, no. Oh.
I mean.
No. Comedy's going to end up being knock-knock jokes. That's all it can be. And that even might be offensive for some.
Dennis in Villa Park, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, that's kind of like we're living the Cabaret movie where they start out where everything's humorous and fun, and by the time the Nazis took over, there's actually no humor left.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Thanks for the call, Dennis. Tom in Deer Park.
Good morning. I'd reference Norman Lear that produced All in the Family, one of the most iconic shows of all time. He's one of the wealthiest and most powerful men in Hollywood, and he gave a career to Rob Reiner that played the Meathead, who's one of the biggest progressive liberals in Hollywood at this time. So a mere 40 years, they were skewering it, and now they're eating themselves over it.
Thanks for the call,
Tom. Who are these
Tom?
People who seriously dig up into people's past looking for inappropriate behavior? Have they nothing better to do with
their
lives?
Well, first of all, it's not even arguably not inappropriate behavior. It's comedians using charged language. I mean, it's exactly what Andrew Yang said, actually, who is, you know, commented all about this, that you have to look at comedians in a different light. And as what Bill Burr said, we're not running for office. We're supposed to, you know, different comedians have different acts, but of course some of them have a shock value to it. Some of them use profane language. I mean, do you want to live in a world where you don't have comedians pushing the envelope?
You want to be provocative and edgy. I mean, I do.
Where they're limited, and not by law, but by something even more powerful than law. Their inability to have a career. Lenny Bruce wasn't worried about obscenity laws. If he was operating today, he wouldn't be worried about obscenity laws. He would worry about anybody ever knowing who Lenny Bruce was, because he wouldn't have a career. It's insane.
312-642-5600 is our turnkey.pro answer line. 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
Dave and Racine, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning. Maybe Lorne Michaels ought to be fired as producer of Saturday Night Live. He obviously approved some sketches like the Chevy Chase, Richard Pryor job interview sketch, which include a bunch of racial epithets, which basically got thrown back and forth, included the dreaded N-word, or Julian Bond explaining the reason he thought whites were smarter than, the reason he thought whites thought they were smarter than blacks was because light-skinned blacks were smarter than dark-skinned blacks.
Thanks for the call. I mean, this is the goes. Lauren Michaels has been with SNL since the beginning, so that goes back. That's what Jeffrey's brought up. The Mike Myers game, Japanese game show host, John Belushi's samurai guy.
I remember that vividly. Don't you?
Yeah, it was a cultural appropriation. It's racial insensitivity. We'd be running around to every Asian American politician asking them about John Belushi's comedy sketch 45 years ago. It's insane. It's insane. And it should be alarming, you know, because we just celebrated Constitution Day yesterday, you know, the 232nd anniversary of the document that provides the foundation of this little experiment in representative Republican government we've been practicing. One of the five freedoms enshrined in the First Amendment is the freedom of speech. And again, this isn't a government abridging that freedom. But government politicians follow culture. Where's the culture going? We're all on one big college campus with a speech code now, aren't we? Dan in Libertyville.
All right. Thanks for taking my call. I think it's a great subject, one of which I debate with my four college kids all the time. And the answer I have to the situation is to force the U.S. government to eliminate all race identity on their forms. We're not Asian, we're not Latino, non-Hispanic, Hispanic, white, black, or American, Native American. We're human. So make fun of that. We're human. And so then, who's offended? A fellow human. You ever ask a black person to say, you know what, we're the same, you know, if you were injured, I could, you know, give you blood if we're the same blood type. So how are we any different?
Well, yeah, okay. Thanks for the call, Dan. But, I mean, look, if somebody wants to get up there and do one of these quotidian bits, like white people dance like this and black people dance like that, you know, then whatever. I mean, obviously, a lot of the comedy of black comedians is race focused. Certainly it is Chappelle, Chris Rock, and those great comedians that predated them. Fine. So what? Fine. Nobody is being forced to be exposed to this. You're not Chappelle, Shane Gillis. It's not required viewing. And I understand that he has no constitutional right to be a cast member of SNL either. This is about culture. This is a cultural question. A social mores question, because you're going to be in a situation where most people, being cowards, you're going to fundamentally alter the nature of our society and the things that are beautiful about it, including artists in the area of comedy. I can't imagine Mel Brooks not having a career. I can't imagine Don Rickles not having a career. George Carlin not having a career. That's insane. That is not a healthy culture. It's not a healthy culture. Mike in Pleasant Prairie.
Yeah, about two decades ago, George Carlin said political correctness is just fascism disguised as good behavior, good manners.
Yes, that's exactly. Thanks for the call. You're right. That's one of George Carlin's best lines. Political correctness. Fascism disguised as good manners. That's exactly right. By the way, the phrase political correctness is a Soviet term. We use it like it's a good thing. I'm not being, or it's like a avant-garde thing. I'm not being politically correct. Oh, you're not lying to me? Good. Don't lie. Don't be politically correct. Understand what that means. You're not being a propagandist? I'm glad to hear that. Don't qualify it. Just don't be a liar. Don't qualify, just don't be a propagandist for the state. is really what it reverts back to, at least in the Soviet nomenclatura. Shane Gillis, I mean, I don't, I didn't know who this guy was.
I had no idea who he was. He was a cast member for 3 days.
But that's not unusual. You get a lot of these people that are discovered, and they, and the SNL wants to discover people that you don't know, not bring out headliners. And so it's not surprising you don't know. I mean, there's nothing that's particularly funny in the clips that I've watched. I mean, like, I'm not wowed by his comedic talent. So it has nothing to do with that. But I mean, these items as the basis for his termination. This isn't the cancel culture. It's the coward culture. That's really what it is. I think coward culture is a better description.
Chinese or Asian Americans who came forward and said that they were offended by it, but he didn't want him to lose his job because it was comedy.
Well, there have been a number of reactions to my call for forgiving Shane Gillis. And I've experienced a lot of anti-Asian racism throughout my upbringing. And it hurts, you know, and it's something that's very real. And I do think anti-Asian racial epithets are not taken as seriously as slurs against other groups. But at the same time, bigger picture, I believe that our country has become excessively punitive and vindictive about remarks that people find offensive or racist, and that we need to try and move beyond that if we can, particularly in a case where the person, you know, is in this case, to me, like a comedian whose words should be taken in a slightly different light.
That's all well and good, and that's a fine statement by Andrew Yang. But the thing is, he still has to qualify it, doesn't he? Mm-hmm. Still say, I too have suffered the slings of anti-Asian bigotry, which is could be anything from real bigotry that has an impact to, you know, somebody hurt my feelings because they offered a silly mock Asian accent. What's more hurtful? What is a society that is imposing more punishment on people, more hurt on people, since we're all so worried about hurting our fellow man? Are we? One that says, I was hurt, somebody said a word I didn't like, or made a joke I didn't like, or had some fun at my expense, or somebody ended my career because they disagreed with me, because they were looking to be offended. Which is imposing more hurt, if that's going to be the sentimental standard?
It's hurtful for the reporter to dig through all those, you know, podcasts, because that wasn't funny at all, that podcast we played.
Jeff in Cal City.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Amy, you said earlier that we'd be relegated to just knock-knock jokes. I think that's very offensive to homeless people. What do you have to knock on?
Oh, there, see?
Yeah, that's a great point. Thanks for the call, Jeff. Mike on the north side.
Hey.
Good morning, kids. Thanks for taking my call. Dan, you sound very aggressive and militaristic in your speech.
Yeah.
And I feel offended. I don't have a safe space to retreat to. So your punishment is I don't have a comfort animal, but I do have a comfort whiskey. So I expect some Bushmills or Jameson in payment for your reparations for your actions to be sent to me.
All right. Thanks
for on that,
thanks
Dan.
Thanks for the call, Mike.
I want to see if you can guess who it is I'm doing an impression of. All right, let me get into character. You got to guess who it is, though. Okay, here it goes. If you do anything wrong in your life, and I find out about it, I'm going to try to take everything away from you. And I don't care what I find out. It could be today, tomorrow, 15, 20 years from now. If I find out, you're f***ing finished. Who's that? That's you. That's what the audience sounds like to me. That's why I don't be coming out doing comedy all the time, because y'all is the worst motherfuckers I've ever tried to entertain in my fucking life.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories. Only the biggest guests. And only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. We've tried to be level-headed in the face of the hysteria over vaping after the outbreak of a number of people getting seriously ill, including a handful dying.
Yeah, the seventh person died yesterday, a California man who had already some pre-existing conditions.
Yeah.
He was an older man.
But the way it's being reported is conflates a lot of different issues, which, of course, is always the problem with the press, conflating issues. And here's what we know. The Trump administration is moving to prohibit certain flavors of vaping cartridges on the theory they'll attract underage users. A Wisconsin-based drug ring discovered illegally producing vaping cartridges containing THC.
Yeah, we talked about those two brothers. Yeah.
This is where most of the illnesses have been confirmed to source. Not vaping the nicotine, the flavored cartridges, but THC-based oil, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The illegal misuse of vaping devices is the real issue here.
Yeah, but that's the black market is huge right now.
Yeah, but that's not been the response. The response from New York and Michigan and the Trump administration has been to ban.
And one man who owns, I heard him this morning, he owns a vaping company in New York, and he said, are you kidding me? Now I'm getting punished for selling illegal product, and now the black market's going to surge because people still want to vape.
John Tierney, who's a contributing science columnist for the New York Times, writes at City Journal, the war on nicotine vaping has reached a new level of absurdity. It was bad enough when public officials, politicians, and the press reacted to the recent outbreak of respiratory illness among vapers of marijuana by failing to warn the public in a clear manner. Instead of explaining the specific danger from vaping a certain kind of THC-infused oil, officials at the Centers for Disease Control and politicians like New York Governor Andrew Cuomo told the public to stop using any kind of electronic cigarette, which is kind of like responding to an outbreak of food poisoning by telling people to stop eating. Mm-hmm. The science on this, what we know about e-cigarettes. In an article published last month in Expert Review of Respiratory Medicine, a team of Italian, Canadian, and American scientists surveyed the clinical research into e-cigarettes and reported that no studies reported serious adverse effects or significant changes in pulmonary functions. Those findings jive with the conclusions by British medical authorities that nicotine itself is no more harmful than caffeine and that e-cigarettes are at least 95% safer than tobacco cigarettes. So you're going to ban vaping to push people back to using
the originals.
Yeah.
Marlboro Men, that's what's
going on. Which are more dangerous.
Right. And people should have a choice.
For more on this and the larger conversation about addiction, we're pleased to be joined by Judith Grissel. She is a behavioral neuroscientist, professor of psychology at Bucknell University, and author of Never Enough, The Neuroscience and Experience of Addiction. Dr. Grissel, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good morning.
Morning. So before we get into sort of the sort of more global issue of addiction and the various challenges, alcohol, opioids, and so forth, marijuana underneath that, what's been your reaction to the response to this outbreak of respiratory illnesses associated with apparently vaping an illegal product or using vaping devices illegally?
Yeah, I wasn't aware that it had been narrowed down to THC. So my understanding was that there was a compound, a derivative of vitamin E, actually, that may be toxic in some cases. I think
yes.
We really don't understand it very well. We do know that, as you mentioned, tar in tobacco is really the most damaging component. So I have been thinking, along with most people, that vaping was preferable, but I do feel like that we don't have enough data on it, and I hate for the data to be ascertained from patients who are dying. So it would be important, I think, to actually learn about what are the compounds in vaping and how are they incorporated and metabolized in the lungs. And I think right now we don't know. It's true that nicotine is highly, highly addictive, And if anything, the nicotine contained in vaping will be more addictive because you can get more, even more quickly than you can with smoking. So, you know, I think there's a lot of issues in this area, but they're not resolved as far as I understand.
Well, and talking about addictions, how do drug and alcohol abuse affect the brains of young people?
Yeah, well, so the brain is so plastic. Anything we do is changing our brain. Listening to the radio or going for a bike ride or watching TV, our brain is always very responsive. It's kind of different from other organs in that way. It's kind of a two-way street. But drugs are such potent stimuli. They're really stronger than normal stimuli, you might say. And for that reason, they have really potent effects on the brain structure and function. Now, those effects are going to be even higher during periods where the brain is undergoing especially changing. And that includes adolescence for sure. So between about puberty and 25, there's really the kind of final scaffold, I guess, for the brain is being determined. And during that period, drugs of abuse are really able to produce lasting effects on brain structure, on the pathways and the connections between cells. And those things then help constrain the functions. So things like our mood and the way we think and our impulsivity and our sensitivity to reward. So it is a particularly vulnerable time.
Well, speaking of the vulnerable time, then what is your disposition towards the education that is being provided associated with the move for legalization of marijuana, state by state, but ultimately around the country?
Yeah, that's a tough question. You know, I'm not an expert in law. I do know I was a I was someone who used a lot of drugs in my teens to my detriment and ended up pretty bad off. And there were a lot of those drugs that were illegal. And I do think that we have shown over the last 50 years that laws are not great ways to control people's behavior. People like me disregard laws all the time. People double park, they speed, and they take illicit drugs. And I don't think that better or stronger laws or more powerful, you know, punishments are going to affect this growing epidemic, really, of addiction. So but on the other hand, I think that maybe educating people about how the brain changes and what the consequences are and how, you know, it really is. Addiction is the third leading cause of death in the world that's preventable. So it's a tremendous number of people. In the U.S., 1 in 8 are considered alcoholic adults. So it's just really the consequence of using a lot of drugs is addiction. And it's more likely if you use those drugs during adolescence, but anybody can become an addict. And so I think a better understanding of the science of that, it might help people make better choices, you know, ahead of time.
Well, yeah, that's sort of what I was going to. It's a little bit like, like the education on smoking, on smoking mm-hmm. cigarettes. I mean, yes, there's laws that limit it, but it's still a legal product. But smoking has gone down significantly because of the education, because people know exactly the connection to awful health outcomes. And so the problem I have with a lot of the discussion around, say, marijuana legalization, because that's such a hot political topic right now, is treating marijuana like it is a vitamin rather than a toxin, and, you know, making these sort of morally dubious arguments, you know, well, if one thing is illegal, then everything should be illegal. If one thing is legal, everything should be legal. Not getting into the details about the strength of today's marijuana versus your, you know, now grandparents' Woodstock marijuana and so forth. I mean, that's sort of what I'm saying is I don't know that the education level about the impact of these drugs is where it needs to be.
No, surely it's not. I think, you know, it's not a vitamin, and I don't think it's a toxin either. Certainly not like tar is a toxin. Nicotine isn't a toxin necessarily either. But I think that you're right. We need more evidence-based policies and education. And I think a lot of the evidence about how marijuana affects the brain and development and subsequent behavior is still unresolved. So this is a problem because we're, you know, the way we figured out that nicotine and cigarettes were so bad is many, many people died from cancer. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, it would be, it's a shame that the behavior that we engage in around the world isn't, you know, it's kind of ahead of the science often. And I guess that's just the nature of human beings. But I do think we need more clarity there.
Well, just on the point of it being a toxin, that's not my opinion. That's the opinion of Peter Bach, who is the pulmonary physician at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York. He wrote an op-ed in the New York Times about medical marijuana, saying it's a toxin, not a medicine. It impairs judgment and driving ability. It increases the risk of psychosis and schizophrenia. Smoking, it damages the respiratory tract. He cites a 27 study from the National Academy of Medicine calling the evidence of these harms substantial. And, you know, those sorts of opinions are not being amplified by the media necessarily because they're, you know, advocates for drug legalization.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I think all the association with psychosis and the effect on subsequent addiction is true. I guess I think of a toxin as something that damages cells, and both nicotine and THC are not directly damaging to cells in recreational use. I am against using marijuana, not because I think it damages lives more than cells. Mm-hmm. And I don't think there's evidence that it's medicinal. That cannabidiol, which is one of the components of marijuana plants, is not addictive. It's not something that alters your perceptions. And it does have some medicinal benefit, but that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about THC, which so far, you know, in good, well-controlled, long-term studies has not been assessed.
You talked about your experience of addiction personally. How did you kick the habit?
Well, I started when I was 13, and I used for about 10 years and lost pretty much everything during that time. I ended up in a treatment center where I learned that if I wanted to live, I needed to be abstinent, and although I was dubious about that at the time, I kind of gave it a good try, and the more I stayed clean, the more my head cleared up, the more I realized kind of how much was at stake, and it, you know, began to affect me as I, you know, got the drugs out and I wasn't quite so numb. I'm naturally scientific, so I just decided to test the hypothesis that I had a killer disease and that I needed to stay clean. So I used that proclivity for science to try to understand the disease. And the more I learned, the more I learned how complex it was and how also sneaky in a way, because like me, many people kind of fall into it. And we're just talking about cigarettes, you know, smoking cigarettes. At first, they're enjoyable, but pretty soon they're killing you, but you don't want to stop because that seems worse than death. So that's how it is with all drugs in a way. And so I've been doing basic science in the basement of biology buildings, trying to understand the predisposition for addiction. Why was I at maybe increased risk, and why are some people at increased risk compared to others? And so that's how I did it. I was came in the back door, I guess. I was curious about my own downfall.
I wanted to get your take on opioid addiction too. I mean, so pervasive that it's literally reducing the life expectancy of particular cohorts in America, and age and, you know, demographic cohorts. And you suggest in a piece that I read over at NPR that methadone is actually not a good way to reduce or to assist somebody who is addicted to opiates. How should we be looking at the opioid problem in America?
Well, I think like all addictions, there's no easy way out of it. If someone's offering you an easy way, you should be suspicious, because it's basically like paying back a debt, and you kind of have to restore that account one way or another. And for really, it's kind of a long, slow climb out of a hole that, my drug use dug for me and I participated in. So the problem with substitution therapies like methadone is that you're not really paying back the debt. You're just not using the most damaging thing. I'm especially against methadone because it actually, because of its pharmacokinetics, it's a very long-lasting opiate. It, in a way, deepens the addiction. It makes it harder to get clean. And I'm a proponent of, abstinence, because I think that is a way for a free life. You know, I think any using addict is kind of locked into their using. So methadone, because of its pharmacology, is a very long-lasting drug that you really need to take maybe for the rest of your life. Suboxone is another chemical that's a little better. It's kind of like Chantix is for cigarettes. So it's not quite as good as the opiates, but it staves off some of the withdrawal. And I think it is a very useful short-term strategy for getting over the initial hump. But I still think that ultimately the goal should be to be opiate free. And I think that takes a lot of time and support, and that, there's no easy fix for it.
Yeah, like paying back a debt. That's an interesting analogy. She is Dr. Judith Grisel. She's a behavioral neuroscientist, professor of psychology at Bucknell University. The book, Never Enough, The Neuroscience and Experience of Addiction. Dr. Grisel, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper, hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and in District 211, Palatine, Superintendent Dan Cates, we've talked about this school before. One of the reasons we talked about the school district before is because there's actually pushback to the full surrender to cultural Marxists and trans social constructionists from parents. It's not happening at a lot of schools. Most parents just rolling over. Superintendent Dan Cates issued a press release last week that he wants to implement a full unrestricted access policy. There is a board meeting tomorrow night, and I think it's been moved like from the normal boardroom area to like the high school gym because there's so much interest. Good for the parents of District 211. Some don't want, men in the locker room, in the shower with their daughter. Some apparently believe that science is real and that unless you have a Y chromosome, you're not a man or a boy. So as soon as you can get one of those Y chromosomes, we can talk. Until then, it's XX and XY as it pertains to bathrooms and locker rooms and showers and sports, at least for me. Not for everybody. I get it. I'll give you an example of not for everybody. School District 65, Evanston-Skokie, they have embraced cultural Marxism and social constructionism long ago. They've got their alphabet people week that's going on. give you an example. This is for first and second graders in District 65.
What is it?
I can introduce myself. This part of the curriculum. Student-friendly objective. I can introduce myself using a pronoun I want to be called. I can call others the pronouns that they want to be called. They, she, he, easy as ABC by Maya and Matthew. Those are the materials for the first and second graders in District 65. You know, I mean, this has been going on for a long time. You date back 30 years to Heather Has Two Mommies, and now you're at they, she, he, easy as ABC. And by the way, Merriam-Webster is helping out. Merriam-Webster has now updated its dictionary with the definition of they, reflecting the word's usage as a pronoun that refers to those who conceive of themselves as neither male or female. Met Merriam-Webster helping to redefine the language and give it legitimacy, give non-binary legitimacy. For more on the topic, we're pleased to be joined by Vicki Wilson, the founder of District 211's Parents for Privacy, and has been an outspoken advocate against the idea that gender is a social construct, but more specifically, the practical application of boys in the girls' locker room and so forth. Vicki, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, Dan and Amy. I appreciate it.
So I sort of generally summarized it, but you have the granular knowledge. I don't. Give us the state of play in District 211.
So 4 years ago, as we know, the Obama administration came in threatening our federal funding, funding meant for special needs and low-income kids, if we didn't provide full unrestricted access to the girls' locker room at FREM. The school board caved on a vote of 5-2, and so since then, and what they've been doing is what they call limited access, which is still a huge violation because we believe privacy begins at the locker room door for very obvious reasons. But they've been doing limited access, so the student who wants access, if it's a male, gets to walk past the girls while they're getting undressed on the way to changing behind a privacy screen. But now with this new proposed policy, no privacy screen required, just change right next to the girls. It's going to be total chaos and obviously a massive, massive violation of privacy for 99%. Of the students in District 211.
And so you've got this board meeting tomorrow night, and my understanding is it's generating quite a bit of interest. What is the position of the superintendent? What's his explanation for going from this restricted access half measure to full-on unrestricted access? You know, we don't see genitalia policy.
It's really interesting because 4 years ago, he was adamant. He went on national news saying how schools have a duty to protect the dignity and privacy. He basically, you know, said what we said. He was adamant against full unrestricted access. And now 4 years later, he says he's evolved on the issue and we have to do this. He is near retirement. I think that's part of it. He just wants to submit to the bullies on this because they are the bullies. And the ACLU is suing the district. They want a big payday. We blame the adults like the ACLU. We don't blame the kids that they're using as in their agenda. But the ACLU is suing because the student at Palatine High School, again, was given access, but was simply asked to use a privacy screen, but the ACLU wants money for pain and suffering. Oh. So I think that's our lawsuit. We didn't ask for a dime. We simply wanted a policy that respected everyone, and had they done that and got sued, they could have had free legal representation. Instead, they chose to violate privacy with their limited access, and they got sued by both sides. We didn't ask for anything, but the ACLU is looking for money.
So transgender students, they aren't going away. So what would be a good, should they have their own locker room?
So our stance is, yes, gender dysphoria is an issue. I've heard from people who said they suffered from it as kids for years. But the feelings went away, and they're so glad they didn't grow up today and go on sterilizing hormones and get healthy body parts cut off. So our solution is let kids be kids, leave them alone, and if they are uncomfortable in their locker room, if it was my child, I would say, okay, let's get you an accommodation if you're uncomfortable there. But of course, the opposite sex locker room makes no sense. So that is our stance. The question that nobody can answer is, why is it okay for a student to object to using a locker room with other kids whose gender identity they don't currently share, but it's not okay for other kids to object to using a locker room with kids whose anatomy they don't share? They can't answer that question.
Right, because they're prioritizing some people's positions over others. That's the obvious
right.
answer, but they can't say that.
Right.
So what's the status in terms of the parents of District 211? I mean, I assume there are many people that are sort of going along with this, perhaps some even celebrating it as enlightened. How do you see this playing out?
Sure. There are people who go along with things. They don't want to say anything. When you do bring up to those parents, well, are you seeing what this is doing to girls' sports? They're losing their sports teams. They're losing access to athletic scholarships. Then that wakes those folks up. But the majority of people find this completely insane. Some of them were okay with the limited access. They are furious about what's happening now. So absolutely the majority is against this. Will they show up tomorrow? I hope so, because it's really important to.
Where's the majority of the school board on this? We know where the superintendent is. Where's the majority of the school board?
Right. Well, he must feel like he has the votes to get this passed. But anything is impossible, and nothing's impossible. We need the community to show up.
And the venue's going to be so big that they've moved it right from the theater to the main gym.
Right. What's interesting is Dr. Cates once said at a meeting, the community is not divided on this issue, which I find, really, you forgot about our lawsuit of 50 families? And he had to move this meeting to a larger venue to contain the outrage that he knows is coming, but the community's not divided. See, what they do in the district is to the girls who politely object is they shame them into silence. They tell the girls, if you don't like it, go see a counselor. And then they tell the parents, no, we're not divided on this issue. So that's when I know we're on the right side of history on this, is when the other side distorts reality and won't engage in civil discourse on this.
I mentioned at the outset of this segment the LGBTQ plus Equity Week activities and curriculum in Evanston-Skokie School District 65. That's coming up in a couple of weeks. Mark your calendars. The point they make in their Equity Week, in part, is the governor signing House Bill 248, making it the law of Illinois, which takes effect in July of next year. All Illinois public schools required to include LGBTQ history in their curriculums. And, of course, they're praising it. This is life-saving. This is groundbreaking. This is all those things. I wonder if there's any suggestion by the superintendent or other proponents of this policy that this is sort of consistent with the new legal landscape as it pertains to K-12 education in Illinois, not just for celebrating, not just having an equity week like District 65 is having, but also changing policies consistent with celebrating LGBTQ plus history.
Right. Elections definitely have consequences, as we are seeing with the Pritzker administration. Legally speaking, with regard to the privacy areas, nothing has changed in the Illinois Human Rights Act. They admitted at the hearing for the Nova Madej case just last week that District 211, with their limited access, is still providing more access than is legally required under the Illinois Human Rights Act, because there is an exception for schools and for private spaces within schools, because this is the last place this kind of thing should be happening. These are minors, and Target can do what they want, and I've been boycotting them for years, but I have a choice whether to go to Target. Kids have to go to school. So this is the absolute last place they should be doing this. But yes, the landscape has changed in Illinois, and people really need to go out and vote their values.
And you're going to be speaking at the meeting, correct?
Well, if I get randomly chosen, so they've listed the rules because the board president anyway, he's in charge of the rules. Apparently, he's not a big fan of free speech, so he's limiting public comment to 1 hour and a maximum of 3 minutes per person. So that's 20 people currently, as it's posted, are going to be able to speak out of a community of over 200,000.
How many kids are affected by this policy? In other words, how many trans-identifying students do you have in 211?
We don't know, but it's, you know, less than 1%. So we have 12,000 kids in the school district, and it's a very, very small number. We don't know. We don't have an exact number, of course. But, and again, there's an easy solution to this because all kids need protected and respected. There are plenty of options. They bent over backwards with the original student at Friend providing different options, which if I was a mom, that's what I would say. But, you know, what is another option? And there are plenty of them that exist. They refuse to do that because this isn't about equality. It isn't.
Right. I mean, that's what comes across. And I think that's something that needs to be impressed upon people, that you know, people aren't looking for like reasonable common sense accommodations. This is ideological. It's being driven by ideologues. And so there is no compromise position. It is either a frontal assault and you stand and fight or you get rolled. And most people don't want to stand and fight, and they know that, and they take advantage of it. And then you see superintendents like Mr. Cates cave, and that just encourages them to be more provocative than they've been.
Right. I don't understand why people aren't standing up to this. I mean, there are going to be tomorrow night, I know, and we're asking everyone to wear red who is coming to support all the dignity of all students equally. But yeah, there's a dad I know of in Michigan. When they tried this in his school district, he called the superintendent and said, if you don't reverse this, I'm bringing 100 fathers with me, and we're going to just stand in front of every bathroom in the school district. You know, he was a military veteran, and so there is a way. You know, I mean, we elect this school board, and the superintendent reports to them. So all we need is to do what the other side is doing and show up at the polls and show up tomorrow night.
Yeah, I wish there were more men still left in Illinois. I mean, there's a lot of men in Illinois that there are a lot of people that impersonate men in Illinois, including cisgendered men that impersonate men, but fewer and fewer around, I'm sorry to say. Vicki, the details on tomorrow night's meeting, time, place?
Palatine High School meeting starts at 7:30, but they'll be busing in activists from Chicago. They'll probably be starting to show up at 5. I don't know. So we're encouraging early arrival. You can start to sign up starting at 6:45 p.m. So definitely you want to arrive by then. And our Facebook page is D211 Parents for Privacy for more information.
D211 Parents for Privacy Facebook page. Vicki Wilson is the founder. Good luck tomorrow night, Vicki. Thanks for joining us.
I have several founders.
Okay. Hopefully you'll get chosen to speak.
Co-founder. All right. Thanks, Vicki. Good luck tomorrow.
Thank you both. I appreciate it.
And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today.
Email from a District 211 resident responding to our Vicki Wilson interview. While residents of Palatine, Schaumburg, and Hoffman Estate should be concerned about District 211's anti-female lunacy, it's only a symptom of a larger problem. The district's ranking has been falling within Illinois and nationally for each of its schools and as a whole. People paid a premium property value and taxes to live in those zip codes with good schools, but under the leadership of a leftist school board and superintendent, they will soon have mediocre schools, high taxes, and no value. Yeah, that nicely sums it up. That's what's going on in Northwest Suburban Cook County. It's going on everywhere. How about DuPage County? DuPage County, average home price in DuPage County, 24% lower than a decade ago in real terms. Property taxes are up 7% during that time. And, of course, there's a correlation. Property taxes go up, property values go down. And the same thing is happening to the schools and places that used to be whose zip codes used to be sought after. The schools in those suburban, leafy suburban communities that you remember growing up, that you attended growing up, are not the same schools, with few exceptions. And you know why they're not the same schools? Because there's not enough Vicki Wilson showing up to ensure that they're the same schools when the cultural Marxists come for your children at the K-12 level, which is where they start. That's why.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. When you've got questions, he always has an answer. It's Sean Hannity, this afternoon at 2 on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. A blunt instrument runs into dull instruments on the House Judiciary Committee. Corin Lewandowski testifying as to, the particulars of the Mueller report. That was what White House counsel asked him to limit his testimony to, and that's what he did. Here's a rebuke he started with in his opening statement.
I think in one form or another, I've already answered questions for well over 20 hours. So now here I am before the House Judiciary Committee to answer the same questions again. Just last week, this committee, over the objections of the minority, unilaterally changed the rules to make this an impeachment proceeding, which is very unfair. However, in the spirit of cooperation, I am prepared to move forward today.
But he's also willing to go back and ask some uncomfortable questions of the House Judiciary Committee.
And let me stress this fact. During the 2016 election cycle, Mr. Trump held no elected position. He was not a government official. Rather, the Obama-Biden administration and the intelligence community, overseen by James Clapper, Jim Comey, and John Brennan, had the responsibility to the American people to ensure the integrity of the 2016 election. I will leave it to this committee and the American public to decide how successful or not they were in doing their jobs.
The rest of the committee hearing was each Democrat, largely just each Democrat, getting their turn to rant at Corey Lewandowski at various decibel levels.
Yeah, at one point in time, I mean, honestly, they weren't even asking questions. It just kept going on and on.
It was the same issue over and over again. The directive, according to the Mueller report, Lewandowski got from Trump to go ask Jeff Sessions, the then attorney general, to unrecuse himself from the Russian collusion investigation, which Lewandowski then reportedly handed off to someone else to deliver that message. That was the topic for every single one of the Democrats, starting with the illustrious chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, Jerry Nadler. Mr. Sardonicus.
Mr. Lewandowski's conversation with the president and with senior advisors to the president are protected from disclosure by long-settled principles protecting executive branch confidentiality interests. And as a result, the White House is directing Mr. Lewandowski not to provide information about such communications beyond the information provided in the portions of the report.
We'll take that as a yes. And the basis for their direction is a claim of executive privilege. Is that correct?
I can read it again, Congressman.
The answer is you're not answering the question. We've already established that you were never employed by the White House or the executive branch. That is correct.
I have never been employed by the executive branch.
Sir, did you ask the White House counsels to be here?
Congressman, as I just reiterated, I've never spoken to anyone in the White House counsel's office.
The answer is no. Was it your idea for you not to answer questions based on a claim of executive privilege?
I can reiterate I didn't ask. I've never had a conversation with someone from the White House counsel's office regarding this matter.
So it was your idea not to answer?
I have never had a conversation with someone from the White House counsel's office regarding this matter.
Was it your idea not to answer these questions on the basis of executive privilege, yes or no?
Congressman, I can only go by the letter that was provided. It was not my idea to provide this letter.
Not your idea. Did you ever suggest to the president or anyone else that you thought your communications with him were official White House communications?
Congressman, the White House has directed I not disclose the substance of any discussions with the president or his advisors to protect executive branch confidentiality. And I recognize this is not my privilege, but I am respecting the White House's decision.
Let me ask you some questions about your relationship with the president after he assumed office. How many times has the president asked you to meet him in the White House?
The White House is directed to not disclose the substance of any discussions.
How many times did you meet with the president alone in the White House in 2017?
I don't know the answer to that.
How many times did he direct you to deliver a message to a member of his cabinet?
The White House's director had not disclosed the substance of any discussions with the president.
Did he ever discuss with you any concerns that he may have committed a criminal offense?
The White House has directed not disclose the substance of any discussions with the president or his advisors to protect executive branch confidentiality.
Right,
I recognize this is not my privilege.
Mr. Chairman, I make a point of order. Pursuant to Clause 2J2A of Rule 111, that the gentleman is out of order, he has exceeded the time limit under the five-minute rule.
I will enforce the time limit under the five-minute rule.
I challenge the ruling of the chair. I challenge the ruling of the chair.
The ruling of the chair is challenged. All those in favor of overriding the rule of the chair will say aye. Opposed, no.
No.
Roll call.
Those
have it. Roll call is asked. The clerk will call. Where's the clerk?
Where's the clerk?
Wait.
Somebody get the clerk. Get us out of this rabbit hole. Pull us out of this rabbit hole. I mean, just so if you thought that 2 minutes was tedious and felt like an hour, then you should have watched an hour of it.
Oh, I did. And Sheila Jackson was just so these politicians, you really can grasp their lack of knowledge when you're watching these congressional hearings, because they have people behind them handing them questions. They're not well read. They're really dumb. It was embarrassing.
Sheila Jackson Lee, after asking when Vietnam is going to be reunited, had this to offer.
He called the attorney general to ask him to unrecuse himself from the special counsel's investigation. Sessions said no. His White House counsel said there should be no contact with Sessions because of his recusal. So what does the president do? He calls you in to do what everyone else wouldn't do. He called you in to do his dirty work in secret because he knew it was wrong. Well, we will expose the truth. The president cannot hide behind you any longer. And you should be here to be telling the truth,
Wadowski,
because the truth will set you free and the American people. I yield back.
The time of the gentlelady has expired. The witness may answer the question.
I don't believe there was a question, Congressman.
Yeah. Very well.
Yes, there was.
No.
Could you repeat the question? I didn't hear it.
I'd be happy to repeat the
question. Just a rant.
Can't repeat the question.
I'll be happy to repeat the question.
Gentlelady's time has expired. The gentleman from...
The attorney general?
All right. Yeah, enough, Sheila. You're done. KFC Cohen was there.
Oh, was he finger looking good?
Stephen Cohen was there. And, of course, when you got KFC Cohen pontificating, you're going to get a chicken reference.
So you know something about the law and about following the law? Didn't you think it was a little strange that the president would sit down with you one-on-one and ask you to do something that you knew was against the law? Did that strike you as strange?
I disagree with the premise of your question, Congressman.
You weren't a policeman?
I didn't think the president asked me to do anything illegal.
You didn't think it would have been illegal for you to ask Mr. Sessions to drop the investigation and to just go on to future presidents and omit everything with this president and go ollie ollie in free? We're going to start with the next one about colluding with Russia. You didn't think that was illegal to obstruct justice?
Raise your voice. Please.
Congressman, the president didn't ask me anything illegal.
Obviously, you've never been a judge and won't be one.
Ooh. Oh, now you've
gone done. All these people asked you. They gave you dictation. He dictated to you. A message to give Sessions. Had you ever been a secretary for the president before and taken dictation or shorthand?
Many times.
Got your qualifications now. You were a secretary.
Burn.
This has been more obstruction of Congress by this administration, and you followed their instructions, and you're doing just exactly what they thought you'd do. You are a loyal soldier, except you didn't follow Trump's instructions. You chickened out at the last minute. You got cold feet. I yield back the balance of my time.
And then he had a drumstick. Eric Swalwell provided one of the most entertaining exchanges. Again, same topic. The directive and the dictation to go to Sessions and ask him to unrecuse himself. Same topic over and over again from all of them. Same answers from Lewandowski.
But there's a different twist with this one.
Yeah, this is a little bit different. It was a bit of a standoff over who should read what.
Mr. Lewandowski, I'm going to put a slide up, and it's the words that President Trump dictated to you on July 19. Can you read what you wrote down?
I'm happy to have you read it, Congressman.
Well, why don't you want to read it, Mr. Lewandowski?
You read it.
I think you should afford me the same privilege you afforded Director Mueller.
Would you like to read it?
No, you're welcome to read it.
Are you ashamed of the words that you wrote down?
President Swalwell, I'm very happy of what I've written, but you're welcome to read it if you'd like.
Are you ashamed to read it out loud?
I'm not ashamed of anything in my life, Congressman. Are you?
Then why don't you read the words?
Congressman, I've asked and answered your question.
Why won't you read the words aloud?
I've asked and answered your question, Congressman. If you'd like to read the words, you're welcome to.
Well, you were ashamed to read them out loud, and you didn't deliver those words to the person the president asked you to. Did you have a consciousness of guilt?
I have nothing to be guilty of, Congressman. Thank you.
You still feel guilty today, and that's why you can't read it out loud?
Congressman, you're welcome to read the words if you'd like.
Well, I just wonder why you can't.
I have the capacity to, Congressman. I'll give you the privilege.
You said the president did nothing wrong. Why can't you read those words right now? Why can't you read them aloud?
Congressman, tell me why you hold me to a different standard than the previous witnesses who sat here.
I love referencing reading back passages to Mueller because this went about as well for Judiciary Democrats as the Mueller testimony did. And I also wish Lewandowski would have said to President Swalwell.
Right, what?
President Swalwell, will you not read those words because you can't read?
Ah, that would have been good.
Ralph and Rantoul, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, good morning. This reminds me, it's like a flashback. It's a bad flashback. A few years ago, a former client of mine was being sued by his bank. It was just a hate match between the bank owner and the owner of the business that was my former client. For 5.5 hours, I sat being deposed by the bank's attorney, the plaintiff's attorney, as well as the bankruptcy trustee, trying to get me to say over and over and over that I knew the client was insolvent, which I did not. But it was 5.5 hours of that, culminated with the bankruptcy trustee saying, "You keep on saying that the situation looked bad. What do you mean by that?" I said, "By the situation looking bad, I mean that it didn't look good."
Oh, nice answer.
Exactly.
Other attorneys in the room erupted in laughter. End of the deposition. I was out of there. It was a huge waste of time.
Thanks for the call, Ralph. Well, yesterday was a huge waste of time for House Democrats because they didn't get anything from Lewandowski. And
this is just a witch hunt, and they're not going to go anywhere with it. And fine, it makes Trump look better.
And you had a nice summary, as Jim Jordan is very adroit at doing. Nice summary of the committee's events from Jim Jordan when a Republican was given the turn for his 5 minutes.
So you were part of the campaign operation at some level or another from January 2015 to November 8, 2016. During that entire time, did you guys ever work with Russia to impact the election?
No.
And you know what's interesting, Mr. Lewandowski? When Jim Comey was asked that same question, sitting at that same table, he gave the same answer. When Bob Mueller was asked that same question, sitting at that same table, he gave the same answer. Falsely accused, the president is falsely accused of colluding with a foreign state to impact the election. Jim Comey, when we deposed him at that very table, said after 10 months of investigation, we didn't have a thing. Bob Mueller gets named special counsel. He wastes $30 million of taxpayer money, 22-month investigation. He sits at that table just a few weeks ago and gives the same darn answer. But these guys over here, they don't care. They don't care. They don't want to get to what Mr. Chavez said. They don't want to figure out how the false accusation happened. They just want to drag people in front of this committee and keep trying to find some way they can go after the president.
It's really remarkable. That's exactly what's happened. And it referencing Comey and Mueller essentially saying the same thing that Lewandowski said is devastating, because it speaks to how disingenuous congressional Democrats have been about the Russian collusion allegations, the allegations of treason. Let's remember what the Russian collusion allegation really is, effectively is. It's an allegation of treason. And they have to essentially try to restore their legitimacy, try to shore up their reputation in pursuit of trying to take out President Trump. But Jordan had it exactly right. And Lewandowski, whatever you think of him, boy, that was another waste of time for House Democrats. They're just tilting. They just continue to tilt at windmills. Fine. Continue to do it. I think reasonable people that dislike President Trump, even if you dislike him intensely, you can't look at the performance of congressional Democrats, the pronouncements that continue, even from Hillary Clinton, now talking about voter suppression is the reason that she lost. I mean, give it a rest. Give me a break.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, that guy Remy from Reason Magazine, he's got a new parody video out. He does some good stuff. This is an ode to the socialist candidates for president, to the Beatles' All My Loving. You ready for this?
Oh, I can't wait to.
You got to listen to the lyrics now.
All right, I will.
This is an audio format.
Tuition free.
Ladies and gentlemen, the candidates.
Does adulthood dismay you? Vote me and I'll pay you. You won't have to grow up, it's true. All your bills will be paid. Your adulthood delayed. And I'll give all this money to you. Bob commuted to college for discounted knowledge. So large debts he would not accrue. Lived at home, did some chores. Now he'll also pay yours.
Wait, I didn't agree.
'Cause I'll give all his money to you.
I already paid off my loans.
All this money.
Now wait just 1 second.
You will get from Bob.
I lived in a basement for 4 years.
All this money, if I get this job.
My school didn't have a rock climbing wall.
Oh, my God.
All this money you will get from Bob.
All your work wages risen. Your debts all forgiven. Your child care will be. One free parental leave just takes one vote from me, and I'll give all this money to you. All Bob's money.
Oh, give me a break.
I will give to you.
This is really getting ridiculous.
All Bob's money.
I drink tap water.
If I win, it's true.
You know what? I'm leaving.
All Bob's money.
Not only great lyrics, great vocals.
Communists.
Justin Kosick's getting a run for his money there, huh?
That's
getting
right.
A little jealous?
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. What is the future of comedy? Is there one? We ask the question again, not just because it's essentially being asked in more recent popular stand-up specials by Dave Chappelle, by Bill Burr, but because of the firing of Shane Gillis, who you've never heard about until this week. His termination from Saturday Night Live before he ever participated in a skit because some independent freelance journalist who covers the comedy beat dug up some old podcasts of his from just a year ago where he said, he used epithets to refer to Chinese people. He called Judd Apatow a white F-word, derisive term for homosexual a comedian or something like that. And he said something that wasn't even
funny in that podcast.
About Muslims. But I mean, it was all rather tame compared to, gosh, I don't know what we've been used to for 50 years. From Jackie Mason to Don Rickles to Eddie Murphy to Richard Pryor to Red Fox.
And I told you earlier, it seems to me like the future of comedy is what, just knock-knock jokes? I mean, because no one could say anything provocative or push the envelope a little bit like you used to.
Well, this is increasingly becoming a topic for comedians. And frankly, since so many comedians are like most of the rest of the entertainment industry, men and women of the left, maybe you have some people starting to get mugged by reality, like Dave Chappelle has been mugged by reality. Mugged by reality of their fellow travelers on the left who are going to end their careers. And you don't need a Me Too incident for it to be over, as Shane Gillis found out. For a practitioner's perspective, we're pleased to be joined by Tim Slagle. He is a stand-up comedian, writer, editor, political pundit. He is performing this week at CG's Comedy Club in Bolingbrook, Friday and Saturday night, 8:30 and 10:30 shows, both nights, four shows. Go to cgscomedyclub.com, cgscomedyclub.com. Use the promo code WIND at checkout and get a buy one, get one. A deal on tickets to Tim Slagle's performance or performances. If you'd like to see him multiple times, I'm sure he'd be fine with that. Tim, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me on. I don't think that Shane Gillis insulted Chinese as much as he insulted comedy.
Well, right. I mean, that's the whole right. That's the criticism, right? It's not particularly funny stuff. He talked about, like, as a comedian, I pushed the envelopes. I really didn't find him pushing any envelopes or extending beyond any well-established parameters. It just sort of was mundane stuff, but that's sort of the problem, isn't it? Mundane stuff, bad comedy, and he's over.
Yeah, well, you know, you think someone who wasn't funny, you think he'd be a perfect fit for Saturday Night Live.
Yeah, right.
Well, how has all of this affected you and what you do when you get on the stage?
Well, I have to be careful of pronouns now.
Yeah.
I can
no longer say he is a congressman. I have to say they is a congressman, which when I do that, it sounds like I'm making fun of black people.
Oh.
I don't know what to do.
So, in the comedic circles in which you travel, is what you're seeing happen, like with Shane Gillis and others, Kevin Hart? Is that having a chilling effect on the material that's provided by comedians?
Well, you know, you have to be careful because you never know when the cell phones are going on. You know, it used to be what happened in the comedy club was just it was a private function. You know, you could say anything if you're working on a new bit. Sometimes, you know, you do say something that crosses the line. Myself, I don't know where that line is. I jump off of more than I should. But now with cell phones, you know, you say something wrong once, and then, you know, that could be the end of your career.
Well, that's it. But you used to not have to worry about saying something that would end your career, cell phones or no cell phones.
Yeah. Oh, no. No, absolutely. You know, it used to be that comedy was the last 10 square. The comedy stage was the last 10 square feet of real estate where you know, political correctness was not enforced. But the correctniks crave that real estate.
Now, is there any way, because I always, whenever we go to a comedy store or comedy show, I can't stand all the cell phones. People don't enjoy the moment. Is there any way to ask them to put their cell phones down, or do you think there'll ever be a time where they just say, turn off your cell phones and keep them in your purse or your pocket?
Well, actually, you know, it's interesting, Amy. There's a lot of the comics that have been getting in trouble, like Louis C.K., it's in their rider that you have to have envelopes provided at the club for people's cell phones. Oh. So they can't use them during the show. Mm. So it's, yeah, I think you're absolutely right. That will be the future, is that you're going to have to check in your cell phones, which will be a great leap forward get rid of the spy devices.
Okay, Chairman Mao, great leap forward. let me ask you this. You're somebody who performs clean. And I've heard many of your bits on the comedy stations on Sirius as well. But you cover political topics, and I wonder when you say cover climate change and you make fun of the left's climate change predictions, the apocalyptic end of the world stuff that comes from the left on the topic, how audiences receive that?
They can't see the hypocrisy. Which is, you know, when Pat Robertson says that a hurricane was caused by homosexuality, it's a joke. But when you say that it's caused by SUVs, that's taken seriously. You know, myself as both sides seem equally implausible.
Well, right. So, I mean, that's sort of the question is, can the left laugh at itself? Because obviously the audiences that you're taking in at CG's or anywhere else, it's going to be a mixed bag politically.
Yeah. Well, that's the hardest thing with political comedy right now, is that it's a 50-50 split. And it used to be that it was just the left that was that couldn't laugh at itself. But after, you know, after being called deplorables for 2 years, I noticed that the right doesn't like being made fun of anymore either.
So then what do you do?
So I have to disguise my political humor. I hide it into stories about feeding snapping turtles.
Feeding snapping turtles straws, plastic straws, I presume.
Exactly.
So the show that you're doing this weekend, how long does it take to prepare for something like this?
Oh, all my life, Amy.
Oh my.
Yes. It's all led up to this moment Friday night. Yeah.
I've been doing this for 30 years now. I'm at the point where there's nothing else I can do. I have a gap in my resume, the exact length of a very serious prison sentence.
What is your favorite political bit to sort of shock the audience, to get sort of the oohs or even the silence that you're willing to risk it? Is it taking on, guns? Is it taking on climate? What is it?
Here's probably the most interesting thing, because there's a big split in age between the first show and the second show. Because the first show, you know, those are the people that tend to have babysitters at home. The second show are people that still live with their parents and want to get out of the house. So I do a bit that if you're talking to tech support and you want to talk to an American, all you have to do is press 2 for Spanish.
That's good.
And yeah, that's the exact response I get from the first show. The second show just looks at me.
Right.
It's like, oh my gosh, it's like my drunk uncle at Thanksgiving.
Right. Yes. Yeah. You're an anachronism. Right. Do you do any impersonations, or are those verboten now, particularly in the wake of the Shane Gillis implosion?
Yeah. Well, I used to do a funny tech support voice when I would do that bit. But yeah, I'm not allowed to do that funny tech support voice because I was told that I don't look like the guy in tech. And it's like, well, how do you know? He's on the phone. You know,
right.
he told me his name is Josh.
I know.
You have no idea what he looks like.
Do you do you tackle Trump?
A little bit. I want to give it all away. But yeah, there's definitely stuff to make fun of there. Of course, it is hard to make fun of him because it's pretty much all been covered. You know, it's hard not to be. It's hard to be a political comic and not be hack nowadays.
Well, and I assume, again, just coming from, a perspective that's opposite Bill Maher, you don't get the same margin of error, I suspect.
Oh, yeah, absolutely not. It's always been. And I know a lot of conservative comics that you'll never know are conservative comics because they keep it a secret. You know, in society today, it's easier to tell people that you like to wear women's lingerie than it is to admit who you voted for.
Well,
now that's a funny joke, and you should use that in your shows.
Amy will produce your show for you.
Yes.
I mean, here's the thing is, you know who the conservative comics are. You know how you can tell them? Most of them don't do politics. I mean, somebody like a Brian Regan. Sometimes like a Brian Regan, I think of. I know he's conservative because he doesn't do politics.
Yeah. No. Absolutely. It's. I know a few, but I don't. Boy, I don't want to out them.
Well, of course, wow. No, exactly, okay. Right. You don't want to end careers here this morning. But going back to the initial part of the discussion, I mean, thinking about statements that have been made recently from the likes of Steve. Forget Mel Brooks. Forget people talking about Don Rickles, as I mentioned at the outset of the segment. Jerry Seinfeld saying he's not sure Seinfeld could be made today. Steve Carell saying he's not sure The Office could be made today. I mean, what does that tell you about our culture?
Yeah, well, even Tropic Thunder, do you remember that? That was only about 10 years ago.
Yeah, sure, Robert Downey Jr.
couldn't even be made today.
Yeah, because Robert Downey Jr. was in blackface.
Right.
Right.
Yeah,
but it was done
there was also the R word was a running gag in that movie.
Right. Right.
And this is the first I actually saw. This is the first year. This is the first summer where there was not a single comedy hit this summer. And to me, that's probably the reason is that half the, you know, most of the funny parts of the script never made it into the final cut.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, it happens so fast, doesn't it? That is really interesting about the lack of a comedy blockbuster this summer. Huh?
Yeah, yeah. And you know, like I said, Tropic Thunder, it was only 10 years ago.
Oh, my gosh, it seems like a lifetime ago.
Yeah. So
he is Tim Slagle. Yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Tim.
Oh no, we got crossed there for a second. You know, people are saying that comedy's doing fine. You know, the clubs are thriving. You know, CG's Comedy and Bowling Brook's been doing great. They've been doing sellout crowds. But it's that's where comedy's going now. It's going to the clubs. It's going to the streaming specials. It's mainstream comedy. I don't know. You know, nobody wants to invest in a movie that that's going to cost $100 million to. They're not going to take that risk.
They're
not going to take that risk with Saturday Night Live. You know, John Belushi, it's probably one of the only funny things ever on Saturday Night Live. They probably won't be able to run his Samurai Night Live skits anymore.
Oh, yeah, exactly. We played some of that earlier.
Exactly. No, and then you've got the minders, right? You've got the censors that are all apparatchiks that are going to give all of these movies funnyectomies because somebody may be offended.
Yeah.
Could
you have seen a character during the Obama years attacking President Obama the way Alec Baldwin did President Trump?
No.
You know, I think that's probably the reason why Trump supporters aren't laughing anymore. It's because, you know, hey, we weren't allowed to make jokes for 8 years. And now all of a sudden we're discovering presidential comedy.
Well, right. I mean, the old late night talk show hosts, the Johnny Carsons of the world, they would tackle whoever was in political power, whoever was in office, and make fun of that person. But now it's not the same. Now the Jimmy Kimmels and the Colberts, they're weaponized for the left to attack Trump and have Michelle Obama, have Barack Obama do the bidding of politicians on the left while they attack politicians on the right. And it's obvious.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. It's they were treated with. I can't remember anything vicious on. You know, the only Saturday Night Live skit was that when Obama got mad, he turned into The Rock Obama.
Yeah,
and
I
got
remember
really
that
mad.
One.
Yeah, hilarious.
Yeah, yeah, right. Yes, yeah.
That's because The Rock was hosting that.
A parody that makes you look better. Vicious. Yeah, right. Tim Slagle.
That's the way they hit Jimmy Carter too. After Chevy Chase spent all those years making Jerry Ford look like a bumbling fool, it's Jimmy Carter. The Jimmy Carter impression. He played somebody that was such a genius. He knew how to overhaul a slant six engine.
Tim Slagle, stand-up comedian, writer, editor, political pundit. He is live at CG's Comedy and Bolingbrook this Friday and Saturday. Two shows, 8:30 and 10:30, four shows total. Go to cgscomedyclub.com, cgscomedyclub.com, and use the promo code WIND, and you get a buy one, get one free deal. Tim, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for having me on. It's been fun.
All right, have great shows this weekend. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Time now for another reason why Dan Proft is single.
I put the sing in single. Me and Lizzo. Why Dan Proft is single, the story of Mayor Rudy Giuliani, who's getting divorced again.
How many times has this cat been married?
I think this is four. Is
Maybe
that four?
He should just date and not marry. You can do that, you know. But you've never been married. You're single, and tell us why, Dan.
Primary issue in the divorce proceedings with one Judith Nathan is Giuliani's current income. His wife believes that Giuliani left his law firm, Greenberg Traurig, in 2018, a month after the divorce was filed, chose to work for President Trump pro bono in order to reduce any future alimony.
Oh.
Giuliani earned $8 million in 2016, $9.5 million in 2017.
Well, he's going to have to pay up.
Funding the couple's $230,000 a month lifestyle.
What?
And then in 2018, it dipped to $6.8 million. Then she filed for divorce. Then he went pro bono. I mean, that's just right. Giuliani now gives his wife $42,000 a month.
Are you kidding me?
No, I'm not kidding
you. I want to be her.
Well,
$42,000.
He's 76. He's well within your range.
Oh, you know what? I actually could date him. It's pretty. It's age appropriate.
Sure. I mean, what's Edward James Olmos now? He's like 85.
Maybe I'm dating Edward James Olmos.
I feel betrayed by a man that I supported in every way for more than 20 years, Mrs. Giuliani said in an interview. It's sad to know. Listen to this.
Okay.
It's sad to know that the hero of 9/11 has become a liar.
Oh, vicious. She's hitting him hard.
It's going in both directions. Every single one of his closest friends, she diminished those relationships. She slaughtered those relationships and friendships, said Giuliani friend and convicted felon Bernie Kerik. So $42,000 a month, yeah, to have her.
What would you even do with all that money?
What do you mean, what would you do with it?
If I had $42,000 a month, I wouldn't be driving a used minivan. Well, oh, yeah. Mama would get herself a brand new minivan.
All right. Well, Rudy G is looking for a rebound because this saga is why Dan Proft is single.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
I like mine with lettuce and tomato. Hides 57 and French fried potatoes. Big kosher pickle and a cold draft beer. Well, good God almighty, which way do I steer for my cheeseburger in
Paris? Dan and Amy and, who sings?
That's your guy.
That's the guy I hate, right?
Right. Jimmy Buffett.
Yeah.
Well, this is the best song terrible. He sings, though.
No, but it is National Cheeseburger Day, so it is appropriate. I'll endure it. And we're pleased to have in studio Liz Lamb from Wayback Burgers in Oakbrook Terrace, and she has come bearing gifts. Now, we like to be a welcoming sort here in Chicago. Wayback Burgers, a new entrant into the marketplace. The store in Oakbrook Terrace, Liz, has only been around a couple of years. Oh, we need to put our microphone on so the people can hear us.
Got it.
Oh, there we go. All right. tell us about Wayback Burgers in Oakbrook Terrace.
Okay, well, Wayback Burgers is actually a franchise that's been around for about 27 years. We have about 160 locations total. We're in 30 states. We even have like 8 global locations, so we're getting ourselves around.
And what makes your cheeseburger unique? Because this is amazing. There's something different in here, and I don't know what it is.
Well, we're actually promoting because of National Cheeseburger Day, and it's kind of like an ode to Oktoberfest. So since that's coming up, we're kind of preparing for that. And starting today, we have something called the Das Beer Burger.
Das Beer Burger?
Yes. So it's really interesting. It's a 100% all beef patties. They are fresh, never been frozen. They have the burger has Bavarian mustard, and it has beer cheese and French's onions, and it's served on a very, very toasty pretzel.
Is everybody serving it in Lederhosen as well?
I'm not exactly sure.
Let me just say something too. I mean, we're welcoming her in studio. The only reason is because Dick Portillo sold out to that private equity company and made a mint. Because otherwise, Oakbrook and this area, this is Portillo's country. And, you know, you don't come in here.
And McDonald's.
With your Das Burger business without paying fealty to Dick Portillo and Portillo's. But because it's a big corporate operation now, we're going to give you an exception.
Oh, well, thank you. Exactly.
We're going to let you operate in the Western Burbs and in Chicago.
Are there going to be more franchises popping up in Chicago area?
Absolutely. It's a growing franchise. We our owner actually has a license to open a few more.
And so what's the you've given us sort of the burger and the Oktoberfest burger, but how's Wayback Burger different than all of the other burger joints or?
Well, you know, first of all, our burgers are a higher lean content, so they're not very greasy, which I think is
big
plus.
It's so good.
But they are extremely tender still. So it's actually great meat, and it's an actual ball of ground beef that we freshly press onto a grill. So we don't have anything in our restaurant sitting in a warmer. I actually have someone who comes every morning, and their job is to do nothing but cut produce. So you don't have, like, tomatoes from 3 days ago. This is everything is made fresh to order.
And you also have shakes. Tell us about
those. We do. They are made with real milk, real ice cream. If you order, you know, I mean, as opposed to so many places that serve artificial things, you know. And if you do like a strawberry or a strawberry banana, it's actual fruit puree, you know, instead of just artificially sugar syrup kind of thing.
No, that's important.
Yeah, it's finally that it's about time that Oberweis guy got some competition and just had the run of the place all these years. Absolutely.
So besides burgers, are you in this chicken war? I mean, KFC today announced they're having a donut fried chicken sandwich.
Oh, wow. That's pretty interesting.
It's, you know, fat-free, I'm sure.
That could put Steve Cohen in the grave.
I know. Are you guys involved in chicken at all?
Oh, we do. We actually one of our top-selling sandwiches is we have a buffalo chicken sandwich. And most places have, like, a pre-battered, pre-frozen thing. We don't know how long it's been frozen in the freezer kind of thing. We don't. You order a buffalo chicken sandwich at our restaurant, and I literally put my hand in a glove, grab an actual breast of chicken that's been marinated in buttermilk, and I actually bread it to order and then fry it at the moment. So when you're actually biting into this, like, we're talking about juices everywhere.
You better stay away from the Chick-fil-A folks over there on Butterfield Road. I mean, they'll run you right off the road if they see you.
If they know that we're there.
Exactly, that's right.
Well, if they're doing their homework, they know we're here already.
Let me ask you this, though, too, about running a business, since you run this Wayback franchise in Oak Brook Terrace. Getting employees, getting reliable employees, this is a big issue. You've seen McDonald's and some other fast food joints going to automation, both at the point of purchase as well as the drive-through. How has it been in terms of this labor pool for you guys to run your operation?
Well, I think that's just an issue that's going on all over U.S., you know, but I actually am very active in finding employees, and then I have my employees also looking for employees, so we're constantly bringing quite a few applicants. And then, yes, we do the automated thing of trying to find applicants that way. We also look through places and social media trying to get people in. Now, when I finally do get someone in, you know, one of the things that I have learned from other industries that I have worked in is just how to keep them.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And how do you keep them? What's your key to success? Offer them free burgers.
Not at all, actually. No. You know what? I believe that if you invest in the person as a person, then they're more likely to stay with you. And if there's anything I can say very, very with very much surety here is the fact that I treat all of my employees so well that my nickname is Mama Liz. Like, they don't even call me, you know, manager, supervisor, mom. I mean, they all call me Mama Liz.
I mean, it was.
That's like what I call Marcus Brown, Papa Brown. Yeah, we're that close.
Yes. Okay. That's weird. no, but to her point,
that's important.
Her assistant that's with her today, before we went back on the air, he gave her a kiss, like fixed her hair, gave her a kiss, and then left. It's like
so
his
sweet.
Son to the mom, preparing her for the radio interview. It is pretty good.
It's very interesting. And again, you know, this is not for everyone. Everyone doesn't have that type of rapport. It's just something that I know that works for me. Literally, especially like the really young kids at work. They literally, as they're walking out, Mama Liz, I'm leaving. I love you. Good night. Aww. You know, that kind of thing. And again, that may not work in many other places, but I know for a fact that because I invest in their lives, I ask them how they're personally doing, and I make sure that I ask them questions just about their everyday life, that when I do ask them about things about work. And then the other thing is I work hard myself, so it's not like they see someone who's just barking orders at them while the person sits at the desk.
You know, another potential labor pool that you should think about fishing in, University of Iowa grads in the Chicagoland area, because they're going to be back. They're not going to have a lot of career options. And so to get them into anything productive.
Don't answer the question.
I'm just trying, you know, because you always have to be closing. You always have to be out there looking for talent. And I mean, that Iowa grad population.
Got it.
I think there may be some diamonds in the rough there.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, I'm willing to hire anyone who wants to have a
job. Very good. Very good. Now, what did you do before you ran this Wayback franchise?
Well, I've done a couple things. I've been in the restaurant industry for a very long time. I went from...
Tough business.
It is. Yeah. It is, but I love it. I really do. I've always liked speaking to people. I've always liked just having my day never be the same 2 days in a row. So I started off as a waitress, moved my way up into assistant manager in a very large chain.
Oh, okay.
And then that's how I met my boss, my current boss. He and I have worked together. I've known him for 9 years. Mm-hmm. I've worked with him for 7. And so that rapport there, you know, a lot of people hate their job and hate their boss. I have to say that I am one of the lucky people.
Well, just
I'm
like
very,
Amy,
very blessed.
Just like Amy and Papa Bear Marcus. Okay. Now, I ask this of all restaurateurs, so don't think like I'm singling you out. When dignitaries come into the store, do you have a VIP area?
No.
Oh, my gosh. No. He's trying to, when do he comes to
you
visit.
You think you should create one for certain particular important people, dignitaries,
like
celebrities, and the like? So it can be sort of stashed away from the hoi polloi and enjoy my burger in peace. I mean, someone could enjoy that statue could enjoy their burger in peace. No. No,
no.
It's every man for himself there.
Well, you know, it's I talk to everyone. So when you sit, you're going to have to find your own table here. And I'm going to walk up to you and treat you just as lovely as I treat everyone else.
Very good. Now, where are the other way back locations?
Well,
in Chicagoland.
Right. There's one in Naperville. Someone opened one about a year and a half ago in Naperville. That one's a little bigger in size, but it's a great location.
And do you always have themed burgers? I mean, I'm eating
every 2 to 3 months, right, we always bring out something new. So sometimes it's a new burger. Sometimes it's a new milkshake. For the summer, actually, we had like an ice cream sandwich that we kind of came up with.
That's cool.
And it was pretty delicious. If you're familiar with churros, it almost tasted like churros and ice cream.
Sure.
And for back to school, we decided to do something that that felt a little more like it was school themed. So we had the Cinnamon Toast Crunch Milkshake, and it was absolutely fabulous. We actually made it with Cinnamon Toast Crunch, but when you're sipping it, it almost tastes like you're drinking cereal milk. So it was really, really good.
Very good. Yeah. All right, Wayback Burger, they're on the map now. And by the way, this beer cheese battered double burger with the pretzel, this is really, really good. Really good.
It's the most amazing cheeseburger I've
ever had. And she's got, and we got extras, and I'm going to eat most of them. Liz Lamb, owner, the operator of Wayback Burgers in Oakbrook Terrace, thank you so much for coming in, for feeding us, and helping us celebrate National Cheeseburger Day. We appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Wilmot High School coach Ken Mulholland, a former police chief in Lake Geneva, joins Rick Monday and Mike Ditka in the pantheon of on the field incidents. Remember Rick Monday picking up the burning American flag from that hippie that was trying to burn a flag on the field?
Right.
And, of course, Mike Ditka laid somebody out who ran on the field during the game. Well,
that was awesome when coach did it.
Ken Mulholland is one of the coaches for Wilmot High School. Two students ran onto the field, make a spectacle of themselves during a football game.
Yeah, one had his shirt off and the other one was wearing shorts.
And as one was running through the middle of the field, like he got to about the 40-yard line, coach came up and clotheslined him, put him down hard, and then dragged him off the field. And now mom of student is none too happy that coach hasn't been disciplined.
Well, here's the student who got clotheslined.
Did you know that it was wrong to run under the field?
Yeah, I knew it was kind of a stupid thing to do, but I just kind of wanted to do it.
And he said that he got hit so hard that he got knocked out.
But he wasn't knocked out.
Right, if you watch the video, he appeared to be conscious the entire time.
Yeah, I kind of regret doing it because it just was a stupid thing to do.
So he admits that it's stupid and a painful thing to do, but mom's like, he should be fired. Why isn't he in jail? If he did that on the streets, he'd go to jail.
I'm pretty appalled that a grown man would do that to a 16-year-old child.
She claims her son suffered a concussion, and again, she wants the coach at the very least disciplined for what he did. But I think he was just protecting the game of football and protecting his players. You can't have people just randomly run onto a field.
The kid received a 5-day suspension from the school and a $200 disorderly conduct ticket. from the municipality. And yeah, the coach has not been disciplined. If he would have done it on the street, well, right. But this is on the street. This is somebody who is acting in a disorderly fashion, thus the ticket, and coach put an end to it. Somebody's running down the middle of the field. You gotta tackle him and put him down, and he put him down. And now, don't forget, he is a police chief, former police chief in Lake Geneva, so he knows something about how to
crowd
deal.
Control.
Well, yeah, and how to deal with somebody who's rushing you on foot. And
yeah,
that's what he did.
The school district said it could not discuss what consequences the coach might face because it's a personal issue. But I don't think
personnel
issue.
Yeah, it's both.
It's
I guess.
A personnel, but then it becomes personal if something happens to you. But I really don't think that they'll suspend him because I don't think they should. Good for him. And if you haven't seen the takedown, you got to watch it. It was a pretty clean hit.
Yeah.
I mean,
it was Roquan Smith worthy.
Wow.
It was pretty good. And yeah, real simple. Don't run onto the field during a sporting event. Not that complicated. He knew it was wrong. He felt like doing it anyway, so he did.
Told a local TV reporter, yeah, I know what I did was wrong. It felt like it was wrong.
Well, how does it feel after the fact? Are you properly chasing now?
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.